I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We already heard one case today at 1:30, and now we have another case to be heard at 3 o'clock. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel members. To my left is Mark Pittman, and to my right is Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. Everybody has checked in, and I'll ask the clerk to call the case, please. Before we begin, I wanted to say that there was some additional briefing that was attempted to be filed this morning, and apparently it didn't comply with the rules, and so it is not before the court right now, and we'll just deal with that if, in fact, it becomes filed at some point. Okay? You may begin.
Keep calm and film the police. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Millie Thompson. With Denise Kadir Hand, we represent an activist, Kenneth Lovett. We're here to appeal two issues. One, a conviction for disorderly conduct, and two, a conviction for interfering with a police officer. Both, we challenge the legal sufficiency of the evidence in multiple points. First and foremost, I'd ask the court, would you like a brief summary of the facts of the case?
It's up to you.
Okay. Here's what happened. January 25th of 2015, there was a traffic stop in Arlington. Arlington police officers had pulled over someone who, it turned out, had a warrant for his arrest. They arrest the individual, they put him in handcuffs and put him in the back of a police car. Across the street, across four lanes of traffic, busy traffic, heavy traffic, there are some activists there who are filming the stop. After the man's arrested on his warrant, Kenneth Lovett arrives in a pickup truck and parks in a public parking lot adjacent to the sidewalk across the street from the stop. He gets out of his vehicle, and he's wearing a t-shirt that says, "Keep calm and film the police." And he has a camera up like this, up to his face, filming. And he's there for approximately 45 seconds between the time he exited his vehicle and then a police officer makes contact with him, tells him to put it in his vehicle, which is a Curio pre-1899 antique replica of a pistol. Tells him to put it in his vehicle. He does not, and he's arrested. And this all takes about 45 seconds to happen. Before all of this, the man across the street had already been placed under arrest and handcuffs. And we see all of this transpire in a video that was admitted under State's Exhibits 3 and 4. So first and foremost, under Texas Government Code 311.021, we presume that any statute that's enacted is meant to be in compliance with the Constitution. And we have three co-equal rights in terms of the First Amendment that inform us in Mr. Lovett's arrest. First, we have the right to be public and the right to be present in a public place. Second, we have the right to gather information on a matter of public concern. And third, we have a right to speak on a matter of public concern. And these are co-equal rights, and it makes sense they're co-equal rights because it wouldn't really help anybody if they had a right to speak if they could only do it in their closet. And if they had no right to gather information, then they really wouldn't have anything interesting to say. The right to gather information is co-equal, or is the same as the right that the media has. And by definition, a matter of public concern includes the police. So Kenneth Lovett, by arriving there in public and filming the police, his conduct was on all fours with his First Amendment constitutional right. And then we have the Second Amendment right, obviously, to keep and bear arms. And the Supreme Court, in a 2010 case, said that it was a fundamental right. So these two constitutional rights overlap in this case, and we see how they can overlap in an opinion by the Beaumont Court of Appeals in Ex Parte Poe, which is cited in appellant's brief.
That case wasn't decided on the merits of a conviction, though, was it?
No, it was not. It was a preemptive challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. But there's some great language in there on how to deal with disorderly conduct since there aren't a whole lot of cases on it. And in particular, they focus on the language calculated to cause alarm. And they go to the dictionary and they define these phrases with dictionary definitions. So calculated means planned, And alarm means to instill fear from a sudden sense of danger. In this situation, we challenge the legal sufficiency, and we argue that Mr. Lovett, by arriving and being present in a public place to film the police, his intentions are plain from the shirt he's wearing and from his body language. When he never actually touches the curio he has legally and securely holstered to him, there's nothing there to indicate that he was planning to create terror from his...
In your mind, does it make any difference? You know, obviously on the video, there's a lot of talk about it, how it's a pre-1899 weapon, which is not statutorily a firearm. But do you agree that it still falls within the definition of a deadly weapon?
I do not, Judge. So it's not a firearm. And then in terms of deadly weapon, is it deadly by design? No. These pre-1899 curios, the purpose there is for collectors. They're collecting these. It's not to shoot people.
Did the defendant's expert not agree that it could kill somebody?
It could, yes, and that's what the defendant's expert did agree. Yes, Your Honor. But there is a function to it outside of shooting something, and that is for collectors.
Well, what about a baseball bat? Baseball bat has a function outside of playing baseball.
Yes, and so that would go to the third. Is it, in its use or manner of its intended use, is it a deadly weapon? This court, in a case called In Re S.B., and I have the cite, but this court said in a baseball case or baseball bat situation, holding it down by your side and being far enough away that you couldn't possibly hit someone with it, it's not a deadly weapon in that situation. You actually have to use it in some way. And this case is on very similar to that because Mr. Lovett had the curio holstered and he never actually touched it or brandished it. So we don't agree that it wasn't a firearm. It wasn't deadly by design because there is a function for it outside of shooting. It's a collectible. And then it was not used or intended to be used in a way such that it was a deadly weapon. So, yes, I think that the evidence is legally insufficient on the disorderly conduct, both because it's not a firearm or a deadly weapon, and because he clearly wasn't calculating to cause alarm.
Now, on the calculating to cause alarm aspect of this, do you take the position that it is the defendant's personal intent, which I guess without his testimony you couldn't really know, you just have to infer it from the circumstances, or whether someone in the public testified to being alarmed, or, I mean, you know, whose point of view do you think is really paramount here for that element?
Mens rea should be viewed from Mr. Lovett's standpoint based on the facts as he sees them at the time. So he gets out of the truck, and he's there for 45 seconds, and he's told to put it in his truck. He's not told anything about this secure perimeter that Officer Gimp testified to later. He's not told about effective range of weapons. He's not told any of this. He's there for 45 seconds filming the police, and all he is told is to put it in his vehicle. From his perspective, across four lanes of traffic, heavy traffic, that have not been cordoned off or in any way shut down, there was no reason for him to know that that's what Officer Kemp was doing. So it should absolutely... Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, ma'am. You make a light in your brief that we should discount Officer Kemp's subjective belief as to whether... your client's actions were calculated to cause alarm or not. If we can't take Officer Kemp's subjective belief, what can we consider? Does it have to be your client's subjective belief as to whether he was taking action?
Judge, I think the answer to that lies in the Dunkatel case that's cited in the state's brief and in my reply, Dunkatel. And in that, the language is that it's not relegated to an officer's subjective belief, but instead to it's an objective standard. So the actual language of Dunkatel, interference statute is not relegated to the subjective interpretation of the police officers on the scene. So no, I don't think it's Mr. Lovett's subjective interpretation either. I think it's got to be objective. And the objective facts, we've got four lanes of busy traffic that aren't cordoned off. They're not blocked off in any way. And what Mr. Lovett is told is just to put it in his truck.
So the objective standard is what a reasonable person would think.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And so now I'd like to turn to the interference conviction. And with the interference, we challenge the legal sufficiency of all of the elements. I think that the Carney versus State case, the Austin 2000 case, which is cited in our brief, is really on all fours with this case. And in Carney, the appellant there, he had challenged some officers outside of his home who were executing an arrest warrant for his wife who was inside the house. And he verbally opposed them. He argued with them about the validity of the warrant. And in that process, he delayed them getting into the house. At a certain point, they got antsy. They shoved him aside. They went into the house to effect the arrest, and they charged him with interfering. And the charging instrument said that he interfered by blocking the residence, blocking the entrance to the residence. The Court of Appeals there, and it was written by Judge Onion, said that no, all he did there, and he did not physically block the entrance. The only evidence was that he was verbally opposing the officers, and that alone could not be criminalized, both because of the statutory defense in 3815D, and even if that didn't exist, the First Amendment would still apply.
So are you asking us to basically draw a bright line and say if there's no physical impeding of a police officer that this particular count couldn't stand?
I think it's always going to be case by case, Your Honor. And in the cases that you do see interference convictions upheld, there is some physicality to all of them, even if it isn't a physical blocking. So in some of the situations, people are rushing at an officer, and so by physically rushing at them, they're distracting the officer from doing interviews or from calming witnesses. Some interference convictions are from pulling away your arm, preventing an arrest in that way. It's all physical.
There was some discussion about creating a perimeter, and so couldn't the presence in an inside a perimeter also constitute interference? I'm not saying it is in this case. I'm just saying, it, hypothetically speaking, couldn't failure to ignore a perimeter, a reasonable perimeter, be interference without physically engaging with the police?
Yes, and I think that objectively the person would have to know that there is a perimeter. So you would need some police tape, you would need some cones, you would need some indication that they're cordoning off this area and that you're not supposed to
go
into
it. Or an instruction from the police.
Or an instruction. So, for example, the Faust skirmish line, right? You have physical officers creating a line and telling you you can't go past it. That makes sense. In this situation, no one told him anything about a perimeter. And not only did he wasn't told about a secure perimeter, but he wasn't charged with that. And so I think that the information, in order for the secure perimeter part to even come in, he would have to be charged with it, because that's a separate offense from interfering with the traffic investigation. And I say that because if we look at this as a result-oriented offense, the gravamen of the offense is there's a complainant, the officer, and there's the actual harm of the interfering. And there are a wide number of ways you can interfere with an officer. You could prevent them from opening your car door. That could be one interference. And then later, 20 minutes later, you could pull your arm away from them to prevent them from arresting you. I think those would be two separate charges. Here, he's only charged with interfering with a traffic investigation.
Was it so limited to just interfering with the traffic stop investigation?
I think that he was charged with interfering with the officer's ability to create a perimeter, or not, I'm sorry, strike that. He was charged with interfering with the officer's ability to keep the peace or maintain the peace, and then with interfering with
and
the traffic
or
stop.
Assisting in a traffic stop.
That's right. I don't think any objective no reasonable person from Lovett's standpoint could have known that he was going to be interfering with the stop through four lanes of busy traffic when the officer doesn't tell him anything. And there's nothing for him to see so that he can interpret it in such a way that I'm going to be interfering if I do this. Because all of the things that Lovett does are squarely within his constitutional rights of being present in a public place, gathering information on a matter of public concern as an activist, and because we can see his intent on his T-shirt, keep calm and film the police. None of this rises to the level of either offense.
Yes. His passenger, as I understand it, Mr. Watkins, had an AK-47 that he did put back in the truck after Officer Kemp asked him to. If Mr. Watkins had declined, would you be making the same argument that an AK-47, he had a right to hold on to that, just as Mr. Levitt, you say, has a right to keep his replica antique holstered?
I think it's slightly different because the AK-47, if that's what it was, it's not a curio. So there's the issue of displaying something that's a deadly weapon. But still, if Mr. Watkins was also filming the police, the long arm, the long gun, is excluded from firearm and excluded from the law that prevents people from carrying those openly. So I think there's an issue there, but I'm not sure. I haven't thought about it. And I will, if we can reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm obviously not Mark Cradiville. Through the years, I've found that sometimes it's a blessing and a curse if you are the person arguing a case you didn't write the brief on. So I might have a small addition after hearing opposing counsel's argument, but I wanted to start out and say I have a copy of the letter brief that they filed. Ms. Thompson sent that to me already, so I have that, and I have no objection. I know she'll need to file the documents and certifications that you guys require, but we don't have any objection to her letter brief. So just
thank you for letting us know.
Okay, this is a case. I want to start out by telling you what this is not, because there's two points of error. There's two offenses here. We have interference with police, and we have disorderly conduct. And we have two convictions that the jury came back on in very short shrift. In this scenario, at the trial, no one made any as-applied or facial claim about unconstitutionality. Not that constitutional amendments weren't discussed at trial. The first and the second were both discussed by both parties. But there is no claim in the record in those regards. Again, on appeal, that's not the points of error presented to this court.
But do you agree, though, that we can look to the language in Poe, which does seem to be maybe the only case that really discusses this particular statute? Do you think that we can learn something from the way the Poe court dissected it?
I absolutely agree. For one, since it's written by former presiding judge, Judge Ungen, I think it's always golden when he writes things, and I agree. And in fact, he says that the defense that's included in the disorderly conduct statute codifies that, and when I get to the specific offense, I think that's how you apply the constitutional claim. And clearly, based on the specific manner and means that we alleged, we were not alleging anything that was protected. So, yes, I agree, and I would draw your attention to it's paragraph 13 at the very last, and in that case, and just to have the background, Poe is a case where a gentleman who I believe was a gun store owner in a mall went strolling through the mall with a gun like Mr. Watkins, our defendant's passenger, had, and he caused a lot of people to be alarmed, as you can read from the opinion.
Right. In fact, there were multiple 911 calls.
Yes.
But here, I mean, what is the evidence you would point us to in the record that Mr. Levitt intended to cause alarm by his actions?
I think that showing up for a traffic stop to not just to film, but to film while wearing a gun, I think it's those two things that's the alarm. And it certainly, direct testimony shows that the officer was alarmed. Actually, the defense expert, Mr. Osborne, who is a prior Marine, and on cross-examination, Prosecutor Welchel went into a lot of interesting discussion about the gentleman's prior military experience and how, when he had set up a perimeter, he would have been alarmed. He didn't use the word alarm, but
so anytime someone shows up at the scene or near the scene of something wearing a firearm that they're authorized to wear, it's ipso facto a disorderly conduct?
I think, again, the cases say that it's going to be case by case. This was a scenario.
But that's what you're relying on. You're relying on the fact that they were wearing the gun at the scene.
With all of the other circumstances in this scenario, I am certain.
And filming.
I'm certain that I could come up with some law school example of a scenario where it was not a problem. But in this scenario where it was a felon who was being arrested, I actually counted the cars that had gone whizzing by on Park Row, and at the time that Officer Deary and Kemp arrived, 55 had, let's just say, blown by. There was a crowd of people, just a few, but still people from the apartment complexes on the other side of the police car. The testimony shows it's two apartment complexes that were known for high crime, and then we have people gathering more and more. One of the videos, and I'm sorry, I get states three and four, I get mixed up, as to which one is which, but the one with the person with the nasal voice, he's like, oh, we're the first ones here, and right at that time, more people come and
that
more people.
That was before Mr. Lovett arrived.
That is correct, but there's more and more people gathering, so when you have a felon being dealt with, and you have police officers who are trying to maintain a safe area, not just for themselves, but for the man who was detained and ultimately arrested, for the officers who were affecting that, for the citizens that are standing out there watching this, for the people inside their apartments who gunfire.
Well, we do have, though, I guess, the benefit of videotape evidence in this case. Yes, Officer Kemp used the word alarm in his testimony at trial, but I think you could make an argument that as you watch the video, I mean, if I were a police officer truly alarmed by Mr. Lovett, I mean, they seem to be remarkably calm and unalarmed on the video, which suggests to me that perhaps they didn't perceive this Second Amendment activist to be any sort of real physical threat to them.
And I would call that professional on the part of the officers. And no, yes, they're not agitated or screaming or running away, pulling their hair, scared, or
ordering
like
him to get on the ground with his hands behind his head.
Correct, because this was a holstered weapon. But of course, a holstered weapon can become something else pretty quickly. It also, talking about that safety perimeter, if you have someone who's about to go downtown and they have a prior felony, which is what the record shows. If they're going to take off and escape from that area, do you think they're going to run to the area where people would be easily following them, like to the apartment complex across the way, or they're going to run, what's that game kids had, Frogger, where they go dodging across because they're thinking officers aren't going to so willingly risk their lives dodging across that crazy street, get to those people who have guns on the other side and take matters into their own hands. I think that's part of the calculation here, and that's discussed too. So,
how could someone calculate that in advance? I mean, these people showed up at the scene to film, let's say, the police action, what the police activities, and they don't know that it's a felon, I assume. They see a car stopped. They're carrying a weapon openly, which they're allowed to do. Under your scenario, all of this mens rea becomes dependent on what coulda, woulda, shoulda, mighta, could happen, and it also depends on what's going on with that arrest at the time, and how can that be put upon the person who is making the decision to show up and exercise their First Amendment rights and their Second Amendment rights?
I think there's two answers. First off, you can hear from the discussions had on the video, some before this defendant arrives and some after. Right after this defendant arrives, there's someone who's screaming at a police officer in the background, not this defendant, but you know, we lied to us now, you said you were going to give us a chance, something like that. There's discussions, negative discussions about the police during the episode. But the thing is, so you can see what the mental state is to a certain extent of other people that are in this group.
Okay, where's the record evidence that ties Mr. Lovett to this group?
in this, well, besides punishment, in this group he shows up in the same timing as the other people who have shown up, and Officer Kemp discusses the fact that there have been escalating episodes happening in Arlington.
Right, but was there any testimony that Mr. Lovett himself had ever been a part of any of these other gatherings?
No, there was not that testimony. But here's the second part of my answer. We can't forget the standard of review. If I had a shirt that I would wear here, I'd say keep calm and apply the standard of review. We need to look at the record evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict. And so when you look at these hypothetical questions, I think that's undermining the jury, the standard of review. I think it's easy to get tripped up on standard of review sometimes, unless perhaps you focused for a long time on criminal law. But out of our office, we are well aware of the fact that the Giesa case from 1991 came out of this office, this court, went to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and got rid of something called outstanding reasonable hypotheses. This court faced that not too long ago, and it's so understandable how it happens. But in the Tate case, which the Court of Criminal Appeals just decided this last fall, but it's easy to go coulda, woulda, shoulda. You have
back,
to apply.
Going back to the record, ma'am. What evidence is in the record that this individual knowingly set out to cause harm and to cause alarm?
Well, that's okay.
The fact that he wore the handgun and or the antique handgun.
Well, under the interference statute, of course, unless someone says something, we can't crack their head open and find out their intent. But it's the standard was negligence, so he ought to have known that people would be concerned. I think we look at a case.
But are you talking about the interference or the disorderly conduct?
Right. And on that's why I was going to interference, because I'm sorry, I thought we were discussing that one. But no, it's obviously it's intentional and knowingly caused to alarm in the disorderly conduct. But I think that he intended to come I think he actually intended to interfere, even though the standard is negligence, from the evidence in this record.
And when I looked at the video that was part of the record, I didn't see Officer Kemp take any action with regards to the traffic stop. I saw a large group of officers going over to deal with the protesters. But I did. Is there anything in the record tying Officer Kemp to the or anything that these gentlemen did to actually interfering with the traffic stop in this case?
Okay, so, and that's going back to the interference, that question. Okay, and yes, Officer Kemp testified that as part of, I don't think he used the word protocol, I'm trying to remember what he used, but he was backup to this. So the other two officers are there taking care of the person who's being arrested, and these, he and his partner arrive, and you know, if you were looking at someone getting killed out on the highway, you see officers and fire trucks and things parked to protect the area. That's part of the investigation for whatever just happened on the highway. In this scenario, this is part of the protection of the officers there to try to make sure that there's not weapons. The weapon is the different factor in the interference and then obviously the deadly conduct that changes the game. You know, you see, when you watch the video, you see kind of a little hippie guy walking down the street, and he's coming through. It's on the longer one, and he's like, I'm not with these guys. I'm just walking down the street. You know, he's allowed to go through. He doesn't have a gun. If our defendants had just walked on with their gun, they would have been fine. But being there at the traffic stop was what the problem was with the weapons. That's the game changer in this. Now, obviously, they have the right to use those weapons, but the police have the right to secure, for their own safety, the area around.
They get to determine what the area is. Are they given unbridled discretion to create that perimeter? In other words, could the perimeter be a mile away? Does it have to be reasonable?
I think it has to be reasonable. And, of course, we look at 1983 actions with reasonableness. We use reasonableness in Fourth Amendment law. That's not the hardest job. That's the linchpin of many of our issues that we face. In the video, you can see, I think it's 360, maybe a block or two off. I think if it had happened there, that would be unreasonable. So there's part of the line for that. This was right smack dab across in the middle of a high crime area with somebody being arrested as a felon who could take off lickety-split, and they're trying to protect everyone, and they are backup to that stop. Again, I want to go back. This is not constitutional. We have to look at things in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict. That is the requirement under Jackson versus Virginia. And when we call something a curio, contrary to what the defense expert says, he actually uses the word firearm for it twice. And then he, of course, says it's a deadly weapon. We have to take the record and look at it through the lens of the light most favorable and whether or not any rational trier of fact could have found both of these crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would say the answer to that is yes. Thank you.
Anything else?
May it please the court. My name is Denise Kadirhan, and along with Millie Thompson, I represent Kenny Lovett. I have a couple of points on rebuttal. First, the state argues that the curio in this case is deadly by design, and they do so today in oral argument and in their brief. In their brief, they cite the Robertson case, and in that case, it's a switchblade case. In that case, the court looks to decide whether the switchblade was a deadly weapon, to see whether there was any non-obvious deadly use and whether it was legal or illegal to carry it in Texas. In this case, it is legal to carry the curio, and it's explicitly, the legislature did that explicitly in Texas Penal Code 4601 and 4602.
So are police officers expected to take, I mean, maybe some people can look at this holstered type of thing and know exactly what it is. I don't think that was the testimony. But are the police expected to just take the word of somebody that, hey, this is a pre-1899 replica?
I don't think they have to take the word. I think that they can fall back on their training and experience as an officer. In this case, they don't just have to rely on that. They can also rely on the people who were there telling them that it was the curio that was explicitly defined as not a firearm. And they also offered to let the officers inspect the curio, which the officers declined to do. And so because the legislature has recognized that these are, they are non-deadly uses for these, people collect them, and the legislature has recognized that collectors are not likely to use them as deadly weapons. The state also argues that criminal culpability depends on the frequency of protests, the number of people protesting, and the fact that people are also exercising their Second Amendment rights at the same time as exercising their First Amendment rights. This means that the state is arguing that if a person exercises their constitutional rights less frequently, then they are not subject to criminal culpability. But if they exercise their constitutional rights more frequently, then they are liable to have their liberty taken away. It also means that a person can only exercise one constitutional right at a time. And this flies in the face of the United States Constitution and the Texas Constitution, and it was, talked about extensively in the Poe case. And so we urge this court not to find that a person can only exercise their rights frequently or one at a time. It should be that if a person is peacefully exercising their constitutional rights, then they should be able to do so freely. The state also argues that Lovett should have been aware that there was a substantial and unjustifiable risk in legally carrying the holstered curio while filming the police four busy lanes of traffic and half a parking lot away from a traffic stop in which the defendant was already arrested and put in handcuffs. The state argues that the risk is interfering with the traffic stop, but they can point to no way in which the traffic stop was actually interfered with. Even with the made-up and invisible secure perimeter, that was not even interfered with, and Lovett had no way of knowing that that was even there. The only risk that Lovett was not aware of and should have been aware of, I guess, was the risk of being unjustly arrested. And it is for these reasons that we ask the court enter in acquittals in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your argument. Your case has now been submitted, and we are adjourned.